He groaned, as he always does with me. He said, oh, no, another idea of mine. And then I edited them. I went through them carefully, and as I think you'll see, I tried to retain the flavour of Erich in the writing, but made them simple and plain. I'm calling the book, the first book, Not We But One, Maya Barber on Life, Living and Love. And as I commented in Walnut Creek, if that doesn't get the public, well, we just try something else. But I don't think that anyone who's interested in what life's about could resist such a title. Surely not. The second book that it rose out of the first. I didn't think of doing two, I just thought of doing one. But the second one sort of happened naturally because there were so many good stories that, and that's a nice noise. And Erich, there were so many good stories that I decided to do a second book. And you know how Erich starts off his story so often? It so happened. So I'm calling the book, the second book, It So Happened, ... Stories from the Presence of Maya Barber. And this first story that I thought you might like to hear is a story for the second book. Do you all know the story of the old Mohammedan in the train? Good. Because I like the story. It's one of my favourites. Sometime before Maya Barber began to give darshan to the public, he travelled all over India incognito. This was especially so when he had to do his work. He would go to lengths to disguise himself, to cover, as it were, his personality. His personality or presence was so arresting that people would single him out amidst the crowds, just stop and gaze at him. So Barber would cover his face with scarves, wear goggles, or wear a turban or a felt hat. He would wear the cap that suited the conditions and fashion of that area. In this way, he remained incognito. At the time of this story, we were in search of musts. And of course, there's a footnote with regard to musts. I don't need to explain it here. Before the journey, Barber would have us prepare an itinerary for the period for perhaps 2 or 3 weeks. It would take us a couple of days to coordinate everything. So on this journey, we were travelling in a third-class compartment. No amount of words can describe the condition of travelling third class in those days. Terrible. To get into and out of the compartment, you had to be thrown out through the windows or pushed in through the windows. It is a fact, no exaggeration. The compartments were so full with people sitting on the floor that the doors could not be opened. Many a time, Barber has gone through the windows. You just had to throw yourself on the other passengers and somehow or other create enough space for Barber and ourselves. We were very strong then, mind you. We would fight the crowd, an elbow here and there, and gradually assert our right to a little space on the long, cushionless bench. Then, when we had our space, we would give it to Barber, and so give him a little comfort, and we would stand, perhaps. At one big station, Barber, who is watching the people trying to enter the compartment, sees an old man lifting up a small child and pleading that he will find some other compartment, and pleading with the passengers to at least take in the child, and saying that he will find some other compartment. He was pleading amidst that crowd and din, and Barber was watching for a little time, perhaps 5 minutes, and then through his gestures he said, "Take that child in." I had to be very alert with Barber. We could not allow Barber to be conspicuous, so we had to be very alert to Barber's eyes, his facial expressions, everything, and not just rely on his gestures. I said softly to Barber, "Barber, it is too dangerous." But Barber replied, "Just have pity on the old man." Erich's comment was, which I won't include in the book, I think it might be a bit much for the general public. Mind you, we had no pity for anyone, only for ourselves in those circumstances. Sort of blow the other people. They had enough troubles. So of course Baba had his way. It's a nice thing about Erich, always his honesty, his straightforwardness. He doesn't sort of pretend that to be, you know, sort of be very spiritual and very noble minded. We had no pity on anyone, only on ourselves. So of course Baba had his way, and I, trying to look very big and important, went near the window, and before the other occupants realized, pulled the child in. Well, there was a great din from everyone. What are you doing with abuses and all that? But I said that we would have the child on our lap, so they should not worry about the matter. And I told the old man to quickly find a seat in another compartment. But I said to Baba, "Baba, it is very dangerous. If we have the child and the old man cannot find a seat, what will happen to the child?" Baba replied, "No, he will find a seat." And he put the child near him. At the next station, the old man again comes to the window. The old man came to the window to see if the child was safe. He had a long, flowing white beard and looked aged. Baba signaled to me, "Tell him that he should not worry, but go and sit in his compartment and not come here each time. Otherwise, he might miss the train." So I told him. He was very grateful. He was a Mohammedan. But again at the next station, he came to the compartment. And Baba said, "It is getting very dangerous now, Erich. If he misses boarding the train, you will have to see about the child." "But Baba, it is still more dangerous if I now bring the old man in. These people will not tolerate such action." Well, Baba insisted that somehow or other I bring the old man inside our compartment. It was, you could say, an order. I spoke softly in the old man's ear, so the other people could not hear me. "Look here, I'm going to put you inside the compartment. But come at once, don't hesitate, you should help." Somehow or other I got him half inside. The people started to shout, and the other Mundali had to quickly help me. And the uproar, the din, they abused us, shouting and threatening. Nothing seemed to pacify them. We said, "The child here, we had to give him room. And this man, he is old and worried about his child. He might miss the train and all that. But why the hell did you bring the child in the first place?" And so forth. Gradually things settled down. The old man takes the child in his lap and he is seated by Baba's side. All the time, as I have told you, Baba would be very active, even though he appeared to be so silent. He appeared unconcerned about the affairs of others, and yet always there would be the wire pulling by him. So we had to be all the time on our toes, even while sitting down. So now Baba signals to me to start chatting to the old man. And chatting means trying to find out from the man the names and whereabouts of men of God. This was Baba's work at the time, seeking out and doing his own special work with the real lovers of God. Baba would have us ask people we came in contact with, perhaps the man at the bus stand, or shopkeepers, or train travellers, and so on, about musts, and yet in such a way that they did not realise why we asked or for whom the information was needed. I asked the old man if he is comfortable, and where he lived and of his family, and then had he visited the big shrine in his hometown. He answered yes. "And do you know of any musts, men of God, at that shrine?" At this he looked at me more sharply and said, "Oh, you are interested in musts, but you don't look like a Hindu, and you don't seem to be a Mohammedan. How is it that you are interested in shrines and in musts?" "Oh, I have an interest to visit and pay my respects to the saints in musts." "From where do you come?" he asked me. "I come from Ahmednagar." At that, his expression completely changed. "You come from Ahmednagar? Do you not know that the root of all saints and walis and peers is there? The source of all, the pivot of the universe is there?" He went on. "Are you a Zoroastrian?" "Yes," I replied. "I am Zoroastrian by birth." "You are a Zoroastrian," he said, "and yet you don't know that God has taken form on earth with the name of Maya Baba, and that he lives in Ahmednagar? Oh, you foolish young man, going out seeking saints and musts when God himself lives in your hometown." And the old man continued to admonish and exhort me, and I kept quiet and let him go on. Then he calmed down again and said, "I have visited Ahmednagar thrice in my lifetime, just to pay my respects to Maya Baba. Such is my fate, that each time Maya Baba is not there. I am a poor man. I go a long way to have Baba's darshan, and I do not get it. And you fool, you live there. And you do not seek him out and stay by his side. And, mind you, all the time, Maya Baba is sitting silently by his side." Again I keep quiet and just listen. Then the old man asked if Maya Baba has gone abroad. Did I know if he was in Ahmednagar or was elsewhere? Although Baba wanted to remain incognito, he would not permit us to tell lies. We had to improvise on the spur of the moment. So I said, "He has not gone out of India, that much I know." And to change the subject, I hastened to add that when I returned to Ahmednagar, I would make a point of seeing Baba. Again the old man took up the refrain. "I am an old man now. I do not know how many years I have to live, and I have not seen him even once. Once in my lifetime, I must have the satisfaction of seeing him. I will take my wife and my children to him." He alternated between talking softly and admonishing me, exhorting me to catch hold of Maya Baba's feet. Time passed and his station came. We helped him and the child through the window. Suddenly, after a few minutes, Baba signaled to me, "Run and tell the old man that Maya Baba was sitting by his side." "Baba," I said, "it'll be very difficult for me to face him now." "Go," said Baba, "run. Run before the train starts. Just tell him and come back." Then he inquired whether any of us had a photo of Baba. No one had one. But I suddenly remembered a copy of the Maya Baba journal in my bedroll, and that had a photo of Baba. I got it out, and Baba bowed down to his picture, as he always did when he blessed a photo for someone. "Now run," he said. "Run and give this to him. And tell him that Maya Baba was by his side, that Maya Baba is very happy with his love, that he knows everything about him, and that he need not worry." I ran and came to him outside the station, about to get into a tonga. He thought at first I had got down from the train to pay my respects at the shrine at that place, and started telling me again to go instead to Maya Baba. "No, no," I said, "hear me please. Maya Baba has sent me." "What? Maya Baba sent you? But where is Maya Baba?" "He was sitting by your side. You should have then seen his expression and heard the abuse he gave me. He not only abused me, but also my whole generation." Well, I just gave him the picture saying, "Baba has blessed this picture. Baba wants you not to worry. He knows everything. He is very happy with your love." Then I started to run back because the train whistle was sounding, and he began to run after me. As I got to the platform, the train started to move off slowly, and I could see Baba halfway out of the compartment. The old man was still with me, and as I grasped a handle on the train, I said to him, here is Baba." And the old man with his turban looked at Baba, and Baba blessed him. So this is how sometimes Maya Baba gives darshan. I didn't put it in, but the other amusing little touch was that Erich said that as the old man was running with Erich, he alternated between saying, "Where's Baba? Where is he? So, you know, where can I see him?" And at the same time abusing Erich. But he'd been sitting by his side, he hadn't told him. Not only abuse him, but abuse his whole generation. "Oh, you young people these days, you've got no consideration for the aged." Yes, it's a nice story. All right. Is there anything that I mentioned, any question that caught your attention? There's a chapter on children and pupilship. Is that all right? Am I talking loud enough?
Yes.
Bill, do you remember the one about the artistic experience and how the art...
You mean the Taj Mahal?
Yes.
Artistic experience.
About what the artist experiences.
Who's printing the book, Bill?
We are. We have our own. We have our own printing presses now. That's a part of Meyer Handcrafts. We have two very good four-color offset machines, and we have done a series of posters, mini posters, and poster cards, which you may have seen at Walnut Creek. And in amongst the commercial ones of that, there are a lot of Barber ones. Barber, more in the sense though, based on Barber, as gathered from Meyer Barber. You know what I mean? Things like there's one, for example, which has proved a bestseller in Australia. I love you because, and then there's a line that I took, as it were, from the general theme of Barber on love, like you give without wanting, you smile for no reward. I love you because you smile for no reward. I love you because you invite search without fear. I love you because you sing and invite participation. You know, that sort of thing. I can't remember it. Anyway, they're selling. They're not all of them equally, but quite successfully. And now what I'd like to do now is a series of paperbacks. That's what really interests me. This is my pet at the moment. A series of paperbacks which will go on a stand, a wire stand that has pockets down the front and on the side. And I hope that we're doing Stay With God in paperback form. I want to redo Everything and Nothing with a new bright cover. These couple of books, and books such as those series that are put out by the Poona Barber Centre, but I'll retypeset them and re-edit and add new material and a new cover. Make them very colourful to catch the eye. And on top of the stand will be these mini posters. So that people who know the mini posters. So the idea is they go to the mini posters and they'll be attracted to the books down below. Well, that's the theory.
I think this is where you made your comment that you're very happy Baba did not make it easy for you.
I'd forgotten. I was reminded that apparently I said that it's so much fun. I mean, thank goodness Barber didn't make it easy in spreading his message, because look at the fun that I've had for sort of some 30 years. Life wouldn't have been the same without all these wonderful ideas I've had, and I've said this will get them, this will really slay. And then nothing happens. I say, that's strange. Well, there must be, let's think of something else. Artists. Wait a minute. Well, the Taj Mahal, do you know the story of how the Taj Mahal was designed? Do you know that story? Oh, it's a beauty. Wait a minute. I've got to find it. But, okay, just try and, can you give me a bit more of a clue?
There's a very good
statement about... Barber statement.
Right.
Right, okay. That's the start of the story. Now, the format of the book is... that there's a statement of Barber's, generally short, quite short, and then followed by a commentary by Erich with the stories woven into it. Okay? But also, I've taken stories from the Meyer Barber Journal by Gunny Munsif, and one by Elizabeth Patterson, and a couple by Money. And, you know, there's sort of other material, but most of it is Erich. All right. The quote, there's a quote from Barber which says, it's a verbatim, a little section from an interview. Barber said, love your art, and that art will open for you the inner life. Is that it? When you paint, for example, you forget everything except your painting. When you are keenly concentrated upon it, you are lost in it. And when you are lost in it, your ego diminishes, love appears. And when such love is experienced, God is attained. So you see how art can lead one to find the infinite. And then there's Erich with the story of the Taj Mahal. Is this... Will we read this one? There's so many good ones here, I don't know which one to pick first, but anyway, we'll take this one. One day, as it happened, while at Mahableshwar, a hut of straw was built for Baba at his direction. Then he lived in that hut. I don't know what he was doing. He said he was in the midst of his universal work, and he did not permit anybody to see him. I was serving him, attending him. One day, all of a sudden, he said, "Tell me a good story." And this is the story I told him, the inner story behind the building of the Taj Mahal. The Emperor Shah Jahan and his wife, Mumtaz Mahal, were fond of art. They respected artists, welcomed them to come from other countries, and paid them well. One day it so happened that a certain artist from Shiraz came to India. He called himself Shirazi, that is, from Shiraz, and he was a sculptor. He told the people of Delhi of his art and how he was seeking employment with the king, who he had heard was so keen on art. His arrival in the capital came to the ears of the king, and he invited Shirazi to the palace. He asked, "Is it true what we have been hearing about you, that you are a sculptor from Iran?" Shirazi said, "Well, it is so true about my hands. I do not know about myself. Can you give us an idea of your art? It would be a great privilege, but on one condition." "What is the condition?" "Give me the hand of a damsel, just the hand of a damsel, without my seeing her face or any other features, and I will produce the whole image in stone. Such is my skill, which I would like to demonstrate before you." The emperor asked, "Can you do that?" He replied, "Yes, I can. That's my art." The empress, who had been observing and hearing this, prompted the emperor to agree to the sculptor's request. Again the emperor asked, "Can you really do that?" He replied, "Yes, provided my condition is complied with. You may give me many hands to select from. I will select only one. And if I am true to my art and reproduce the exact image of the whole person from that hand, my condition is that that person belongs to me. You will have to hand over the hand and the person to me. In short, I will have a bride from India, from this palace." Again the emperor talked with his empress. She said she would arrange it. She passed an order that about 25 of the maidens of the palace were to place themselves behind the screen, and each one was to put forward a hand only through the screen. The emperor and the empress and all the courtiers were present. The Shirazi moved slowly along the line of hands. He touched each briefly and passed on. 1, 2, 3, 4, and so on. He rejected them. He came to another hand. He touched it, looked at it, and then put a bangle over that hand. That was the sign that he had selected the person of whom he had to create in marble an exact image. Soon after, the empress went behind the screen to find out whose hand the sculptor had selected. Who was the person he had found so beautiful? But unfortunately, there had been a mistake. The empress was very much displeased. The princess had been the person selected by the sculptor. She had been caused by the other maidens to also put forth her hand, just for fun, as it were. The princess's name was Rahina. She was actually the daughter of a general who had died on the battlefield for the emperor, and whose last wish was that the emperor himself should accept his daughter and take care of her. Her mother had died earlier. So she had grown up from babyhood in the palace, and the emperor and empress had accepted her as their own daughter, and she had become the princess. So naturally they did not want this ordinary sculptor to have the hand of their princess. But what was to be done? They comforted themselves thinking that it was not possible for anybody to make an exact image in marble without seeing the person. The Shirazi was given a room and a block of marble. He was eager and he worked day and night. He was keen to finish his work, satisfy the king and queen, and win the hand of the damsel. 2-3 months passed by, and then one day the sculptor sent word that the work was finished. And what did they find when they saw the sculpture? The perfect image of Rahina. The king and queen were stunned. What were they to do now? They were depressed. How could they give their princess to a commoner? The king's mind rebelled at the thought, and desperately he asked the Shirazi to ask for anything else in his kingdom. The sculptor replied that it didn't matter in the least. He would not insist on having the princess, and he would willingly depart empty-handed. But the king protested that he did not want the man to go empty-handed. It was a matter of great importance. He had given the sculptor his word as a king, and he asked the man to accept any other damsel whatsoever in India. But the man said, "No, I am satisfied. I will go back to my country." Not only were the king and queen and the sculptor unhappy, but also Rahina. The situation had come about through her mischief, and she was sad because of it. The queen, who was pregnant, was very upset, and her health, already poor, was further affected by the matter. The empress sought solitude in the forest to think about it, and the empress created an exception and saw the sculptor in her chambers. She said she was in poor health and that she did not know what to do. She wanted the man not to go empty-handed. She wanted him to have someone, but not the princess. The man replied, "Do not worry. You are the mother of the whole country. Do not be upset. I will go happily." But the queen did not want this. How could they go back on their word? What would other countries think of them? In the midst of this sadness, the empress died in childbirth. The king was heartbroken. He loved his wife dearly, and he pined for her. But at the same time, he had still the problem of the sculptor. Then his chief minister suggested a solution. "Create a beautiful monument for your princess, for your empress, one worthy of your love for her and of her beauty. And this man, ask him to create a model for you of the monument. He is a sculptor, an architect. Ask him to design the building. If he is able to do that, then he should be given the hand of Rahina." The emperor agreed and asked the sculptor to produce a design that would be a truly fitting monument for posterity. So the sculptor created designs of models day after day, but none touched the heart of the emperor. He was never satisfied with the results. But the confusion in the palace, in the country, continued. The king was unhappy, and so too was Rahina. Again the minister came to the king. He said, "Even though this sculptor is a master craftsman, you will never be satisfied with his work because your heart is broken, but his heart is not. It is not wounded as yours is, and therefore he cannot produce a model to satisfy you. You must wound his heart as your heart is wounded." The king said, "Yes, but what should we do?" Very gradually, let the rumours spread that Rahina is ill. In the second week, she has worsened. In the third week, her ill health is serious. And in the fourth, she dies. So it was done. The first model after Shirazi was told of the death of Rahina became the Taj Mahal, the structure we now see, that we now have. Then Rahina did actually die. And Shirazi died because after the death of Rahina, he had nothing to live for. And later, when the king himself was killed, there was nothing left except the monument. This remains and attracts people from all over the world because it has so much love, the force of love behind it. And then the chapter finishes with a quote from Baba, from the appendix of God Speaks, about true forgetfulness. An artist, when he gives form to an ideal in which he completely forgets himself and all irrelevant surroundings, creates a masterpiece. The best of philosophy is uttered when a man surveys the problem of life without reference to the ups and downs of his purely personal circumstances. And some of the greatest scientific discoveries have been made in the same frame of mind. And so on. Okay? That's an example. Would you like a bit on children?
Yeah.
Seems to me that you... I thought of you as a matter of fact. You haven't got one yet, but you will. Children and pupilship. First of all, there's a message of Barbara. How are we going for time? Are we all right? I'm okay, don't worry about me, but it's just... Yeah, you just nod, Lord. You know, everyone just tell me when you've had enough. I'll just go on. First of all, is the message by Barbara about children, and then there's Erich. Yes, the parent should control the child's environment with all care. It is absolutely necessary to have a proper environment created for the growth of the child. And the parents can best do that. What I mean by that is true parents. Those parents who have the interest of the child foremost at heart, and then of their own comfort, their own happiness, their own married life. But nowadays we find that there are parents who shirk the responsibility of rearing their own children, don't wish to care for the growth of the child, and the child therefore grows in an environment where all sorts of impressions are fed. But the parents should know that it is a great responsibility to rear a being in the world. Good food is not the only food to be given a child. More important are the mental impressions with which the child is fed. The personal attendance of the mother is absolutely necessary while the child is growing. The friends of the child and the family should be carefully chosen, also the school to which the child goes. The child should have some companion who is always there and can be relied on, not to be left to the servants or to some strangers or to babysitters. One never knows who else may be allowed near the child by such people. Special bedtime stories should be told to the child, ones that will feed good impressions. And the father should also be very loving and kind, but at the same time firm. Not that he should beat his son or be harsh to his daughter, but he should be firm and warm towards his children. The best way of disciplining children is for them to imbibe from the parents the right way of life. Let them see how the parents behave between themselves, if they feel concern for each other, if they are friends to each other, and also if they are tidy, properly dressed, clean. So the children will in a natural way develop good habits and will learn the art of loving concern for others, learn the art of charity, of forgiveness, of speaking the truth, and so on. If a disciplined life is lived by the parents, then the child imbibes discipline naturally. That's all. The way Barber inculcated discipline in us was to do it himself. What he wanted us to do, he would go out of his way to do himself, and do it and do it. If you tell children anything to do regarding discipline, they will go against you. So you continue to do it yourself, and discipline will be awakened in their hearts, minds, automatically as it were. But you need patience for it. You will have to carry out that particular type of discipline you would like them to learn. There is no other way out. This reminds me of a story. It so happened that the Prophet Muhammad was seated one day with his close followers, and a mother came to him with her small son. "My Lord, please tell this child to stop eating green dates. I cannot stop him eating, and he is spoiling his health. He is my only son. Please help me." Now a person, once he has had a green date, cannot resist having another and another and another. But they are very harsh on the stomach. There is no doubt about it. So this mother thought that if she were to take the child to the prophet, he would say something that might impress the child. Muhammad looked at the child and at the mother and said, "What you say is right, but please come after a month. It is better if you come then." The mother folded her hands, bowed down, and left the place. After a month, she came again. True to her promise, and despite the immense difficulties of journeys in those days through the desert, she came again with the child. So the Lord received the child and the mother and petted them and made them sit down and asked them how they felt and what was the reason for them coming to him again. She repeated the whole thing. And the prophet then, of course, tried to bring home to the child how dangerous it was to eat a lot of dates. 1, 2, 3 a day is all right, but that is enough. No more than that. "I also am fond of dates," Muhammad said, "but I don't eat so many. It is not healthy to have a lot. So will you give me a promise not to eat more than a few a day?" He received a promise from the child, and everyone was happy. Then they left. After they had gone, the people with Muhammad were very intrigued that he had not said the same thing when the mother had come earlier. Finally, someone asked Muhammad. "It was impossible," he said, "to give advice about dates when my fondness for them was worse even than the child's. Unless and until I desisted from dates, how could I give any advice to him? Call the mother and child after a month, but for 1 month I never ate, never touched a date." To create an impact, a force must be there behind it. Unless you live the life you are advocating, there will never be an impact on the heart of the person you're advising. It's a good one, isn't it? Yeah. And so it goes. That's, again, sort of just an example from the chapters. Anything else that you remember? Yeah.
Where is the book going to be published?
It's sort of in the process now, I hope. I'm away, so I don't quite know what's happening, but it was being finally typed out when I left, which was a month ago, and I said, I'd sort of worked out the cover, I gave the whole layout, so I said, just proceed. So it may be ready in, say, 3 or 4 months, or it'll certainly be within 6 months to get here.
The real blessing that you're doing this book, as many times as I've heard these stories, I can never remember them.
Yeah. I know. I was sort of, it's a good point. I myself, one of the things that started me on this was that same point. I'd ask, somebody would say, "Oh, I heard a huge story from Eric," and I'd say, "Oh, tell it to me." See? And the person would start off and say, "Well, there was a man," and then he'd forget the point, I don't blame him. I know it's difficult to remember when there's so much, when there's a lot going on. By the way, tell your hubby that I don't mind the child. He doesn't worry me. I'm used to children. Right. Don't worry. No, it doesn't worry me. I'm used to, usually there's a dozen of them at home. It's our way of increasing the barber population. if we can't get in adults, we bring in children. Yes, and that's why I was glad to catch up. I'm going to do more and more of them because they're such beautiful stories, and I love the way in which you'll notice all sorts of little things in the stories, little asides, as it were, little points about living that Eric brings out. There's another story in amidst this chapter, where Eric says, "I was told this story when I was 7 or 8 by my mother. Now I am 60 years of age and I still remember it." And again, he sort of makes the point of how important it is to tell these sort of stories to children. It's good, you know, it's good stuff. I sort of get enthusiastic about my own book. Yeah. Thank you, Jay Baba. No, actually, to be honest, I mean, it's nothing but an idea in my head. I mean, it's Erich that's done all the work. It's Erich that's lived this and made it so real.
That's why I think it's lovely to preserve them, because they're still real to Erich, and it's nice to have them printed for
Ages. Yeah, right. Anyway. Now, there's another very nice story. Do you know the story of Rabi of Basra? Oh, honey. They get better and better. This is from a chapter called Love. Baba told us this story many years ago. I was reminded of it recently by a beautiful young follower. A beautiful young girl, a Baba follower, who had come on pilgrimage to this place. This is how I was reminded of the story. One day, after she'd been here for some time, she was in a mood to speak out her heart. She said she had been inspired to gather all the information she could about Baba, so that she might put it into her life and live that life and try to be an inspiration to others. But she had a dilemma. She said, "Erich, when I try to share this great treasure with the boys on the campus, I feel embarrassed." I said, "Why should you feel so embarrassed about it?" And when she blushed and hesitated, I said, "What is it? Tell me." "They get involved with me." "What is this involvement?" "They come too close to me. They fall in love with me. It is very embarrassing. It's my beauty that comes in my way." I said, "Why should it come in your way? On the contrary, use your beauty as your great strength for Baba." "Oh, Erich, you don't understand my position. You know that I am young, and there are so many students. When I tell them about Baba, most of them are very eager to hear about Baba. They want to know, and then they fall in love with me, and I don't know what to do." And immediately the story that Baba had told me came to mind. It is a story of the great saint Rabi of Basra, who was considered to be one of the most beautiful damsels living on earth at the time. With Erich, it's always damsels. And I've left it that way. I think it's so beautiful. And they're always so beautiful, and they're always so healthy too. That's another thing that Erich always includes. And the young men are also handsome and healthy, vigorous, handsome, very successful in business. I think it's quite delightful. "Her youth and her beauty were unsurpassed. Now it so happened at the time that a young man from Shiraz comes to Basra, travelling and sightseeing. He is vigorous and handsome and very successful in business." "His business takes him from place to place and from country to country. Now it takes him to Basra. He is fond of sightseeing, so while having tea or food, he asks whoever he meets, 'Are you from Basra?' 'Yes.' 'What's there in this place? Anything out of the way? Anything special?' 'Well, we have fine gardens and we have fountains and all that. Oh, I have roamed many countries and seen a number of big cities. Many such beautiful things are there. But is there anything here that is out of the way?' 'Yes.' 'What is it?' 'The most beautiful woman on earth.' 'What? The most beautiful woman on earth?' 'He is young and handsome, and youth is always attracted towards beauty.' He hears this and he laughs, saying, 'Well, there are thousands of beautiful damsels I have seen. Can there be any damsels more beautiful than those in Iran?' 'Well, that's what I tell you,' says the man. And the young man again goes sightseeing and again asks some people, 'Isn't there anything special to see in this place?' And they tell him of various sights. And again he asks, 'But is there anything special?' Then they say, 'There is nothing better here than Rabi of Basra. The beauty of her surpasses all beauty.' 'How can that be? What makes you say that?' And they say, 'Those who are starved of beauty, they will learn when they confront that beauty.' 'All right, where can I find her? How does one see her?' 'Well, where else? In a brothel.' 'Oh, that's a common story. We have many prostitutes in Iran too. We know of such women.' 'Oh, but this is different.' He leaves, He goes round to different places in the city, but again hears the name of Rabia from someone he meets, and then from another person, and then another and another. And he gradually comes to realize that this whole city is somehow different from the other cities he has visited in the country. This place is charged with such an atmosphere that they talk freely about the beauty of a woman, and yet there seems no trace of carnality or vulgarity in their talk. What is it? Who could she be? What makes her so beautiful and at the same time approachable to all? Again he is reminded, oh, she is only a beautiful prostitute. That's why she is approachable to all. After some days, he decides to visit Rabia, even though she be in a brothel. Although he is from a different strata of life and is not used to frequenting brothels, he makes himself bold to go there. For the first time in his life, he makes up his mind to go to such a place and to see for himself what he has heard from the people. He finds out about the place and the time she will be available. Somebody leads him there in the evening. Go up the stairs, and there will be a matron who will see you and ask you to pay a fee. She takes fees. She doesn't, but the matron asks for them. Without that, you won't be able to go in. Oh, I have enough money. So he goes up, slowly climbing the stairs. And all the time his mind is full of this beauty he has heard of, and of the time he is to pass with her. And when he gets there, the matron talks to him. What do you want? Are you a stranger in this land? He says, yes, I'm a stranger here, and I want to see Rabia of Basra. What do you mean you want to see Rabia of Basra? Is she an exhibit in a zoo or something? Well, is she not approachable? Yes, but you have to be with her, not just see her, and you have to pay a fee. Yes, yes, I want to spend time with her. All right, but the fee is exorbitant. He says, I don't mind whatever it is. He pays her and she takes him to the suite, ushers him inside and shuts the door. But he finds that the room is vacant. There is nobody there to wait upon him. Then he gradually ventures further. There is a side room, and in it a figure is praying. A prayer carpet is spread, and the figure is kneeling, absorbed in prayer. What beauty she has! He has never seen such beauty. Oh, how could she be here? How could she allow men to live with her? He sits and gazes upon her beauty and loses himself. Yet his passion is aroused, and he waits for her to be finished with the prayer. She prays and prays. An hour passes by. Gradually there is an ebb in his passion. He is attracted by her beauty and at the same time by her purity. After another hour or so, she finishes her prayer and looks at him, and it is as if lightning has struck him, the very sight of her. She apologizes to him and says, I'm so sorry. Pardon me for keeping you waiting so long. I was absorbed in prayers. You must be hungry. She claps and her maidens come. She orders, spread the feast for him. He is our guest tonight. You would like to drink something? What type of liquor do you like? Well, I'm from Iran. And he thinks, that's good. She is not too absorbed in prayers. She offers me food and drinks as well. And it is true what people say. She is truly beautiful. So he takes an interest in conversing and opens out his heart. He tells her his whole story and she listens. And as he talks, he just gazes. He feeds upon her beauty. She also interjects a few sentences in the conversation, inquires about his well-being, of his tours and of his work. You must have visited many places and seen many fine sights. Did you visit Basra properly? He says, yes. I've almost finished my visit to Basra, and everywhere I've heard of your beauty, and so I wanted to be here with you. She says, you are most welcome. But after all, what is this beauty of mine? It's a passing show. Very soon I will get old and will be all wrinkled up. Age will tell upon you, and age will tell upon me. And she takes up the thread from there. The talk of God and truth and beauty starts, and goes on into the early hours of the morning, and she leads him to the point where he becomes a real devotee. It is as Maya Baba has said, the best of all forces which can overcome all difficulties on the way, is the love man knows how to give without need to bargain for a return. There is nothing that love cannot achieve, and there is nothing that love cannot sacrifice. There is nothing beyond God, and there is nothing without God, and yet God can always be captured by love. All other essential qualities will come to the aspirant if he follows faithfully the whisperings of the unerring voice of love that speaks from his own heart, shedding light on the path. He says, "What a discourse you have given me tonight. I now begin to realize what real beauty means, how one should behave in life, how one should seek the eternal beauty that never perishes." She says, "Yes, that is so. That's how it is." Now he feels it is time to go. He says, "I am your slave. Tell me anything, anything in this world that I can do for you." She says, "I have one little request." He replies, "Anything. Ask for my wealth. Ask for me. Ask for anything you want." She says, "There is just one little thing, if you can do it. What is it?" "Never tell anyone what you have heard here. Allow the people to come to me. This beauty is nothing but a trap set for them, so that it gives them strength and the right understanding and the right perspective in life. God has placed me in this little hole here so that I can do his work and tell people about true beauty, true love. Promise me that you will never tell others of what you've experienced here tonight." "Oh," he says, "so this is the secret of this city. The whole city clamors after your beauty, yet nobody tells me about his experience." She says, "I extract the promise from them. My beauty is my strength to fight in the cause of my Lord." So Barbara says, every Barbara lover who is beautiful can use her beauty as a great strength to get many more hearts to me. But you must be as stable as Rabia. When a woman is determined to be strong, nothing can harm her. Nothing. Nothing. Women can be very strong. Warriors have fallen before them. So a woman, even though she is not married, can yet be a great comfort to men and help them towards their emancipation. If fate determines that she live by herself, yet she can be a great comfort to so many children, to so many men, young men and old men, provided she is strong and exercises her inherent strength. And Barbara said, it took a long time after that for Rabia to become Barbajan, the perfect master who awakened me to my own divinity. Yes, it's a lovely story, isn't it? Is there time for one short one? I'll finish it with this one because I'm very fond of it, and I think it's a nice one to remember. It's a good one. It's actually one told by Money. It's told by Money about Erich. Yes. You've got a long way to go.
Yes, and we want to get off the road before
you finish. By all means. That's right, Jay Barber. Yes. I'm sorry, I hope I haven't sort of made things awkward for you.
No. Oh, there you go.
Jay Barber. Good. Yeah, we've got silence day tomorrow, haven't we?
Mm-hmm. An
hour and a half. Good. Well, this is about 5 minutes. Listen now. Sure. This is by Money. Seeing this picture of Barbara with a lamb reminds me of a little incident after Barbara dropped his body. Soon after Barbara dropped his body, Erich made it very clear that we just had to continue doing what Barbara wanted us to do. Erich said, "It is not the time to start thinking of ourselves. We have to continue to think of what Barbara would want us to do. We have to continue to please Barbara, to continue to do what he wants us to do." Erich saying this helped, It brought us back to a proper perspective. After that, so much happened. There was little room in our hearts for our own feelings. But after the 1969 darshan in Guru Prasad, Pune, when we returned here, there seemed to be for the first time the chance to think of ourselves, of our feelings, to reminisce, to allow our feelings to express themselves, even though in private. About 2 days after we had returned here, Erich asked me to bring to him some papers Baba had given in my keeping. I said yes, and returned to the women's quarters, and promptly forgot all about it. He had told me in the morning. Now the sun was setting and lanterns were being lit, and I suddenly remembered those papers. So I quickly opened my trunk, found the papers, and even though by then the visibility was poor, I walked over to the men's side. But Erich wasn't in his room. I found him washing his face at the tap outside his cabin. So I said, "Oh, Erich, here are the papers." But he didn't answer. After washing, he wiped his face with a towel hanging outside his cabin. I waited patiently. But instead of turning to come towards his room, he turned his back on me and started walking towards the field, past the mango tree, and so on to the edge of the field. I was puzzled, but all Erich said was "come," and I went. You could barely see, it was so dark. But Erich stood at the edge of the field, and I stood beside him, and he said, "Can you hear?" And I strained my ears. Sure enough, it was so still. From the other side of the field, I can hear, ba, 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 a continuous calling out of sheep, and it sounded like a calling of Baba's name. I said, "Yes, I hear." I realized that some shepherd had put his sheep in enclosure for the night on our field. They do that sometimes on some field or another. They make an enclosure of thorny branches so that the sheep are protected. It was good to hear them calling. Erich said, "Can you see?" I strained my eyes, and because some of the sheep were white and because they were restlessly moving about, I was able to see them. I said, "Yes, I can see the sheep." He said, "No, to the left. Can you see it to the left?" There was nothing to the left. It was quite dark. But as I looked, I saw a darker shape which looked like a big rock, a little distance from the sheep pen. Thoughts raced through my mind. How can there be a big rock in the middle of the field? No, it's not a rock. I suddenly realized it was a human being. It was the shepherd, and he was sitting there still as a rock and covered with one of those homespun blankets. And Erich said, "Because it is dark, the sheep think that their shepherd has deserted his flock, that he is not there. They are restless, calling after him, searching for him. But the shepherd is sitting there keeping his gaze on his flock, protecting them, looking to them, looking at them. He will sit like that, still, facing them, seeing to them all night through. He will not move from there. And when the dawn breaks, the sheep will see that their shepherd had never left them. He was there all the time." I think it's a nice one to remember. He's there all the time. It's only for us to turn to him. Thank you, Jay Barber.
I just wanted to remind those, I don't suppose anyone needs a reminder, but it's customary for all of us. Baba used to give us instructions that we should keep silence on the 10th of July in commemoration of his beginning of his silence in 1925. Some years we'd be asked to keep silence, some years to fast, some years both. And so we continue to do this. And it's